Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today we're asking why we like the things we do. Humans attach ourselves to things that stimulate us and capture our interest. But what are the scientific and psychological forces behind these desires? Now, cognitive scientist Jim Davies is on Gluck Radio to talk about the foundation of compellingness. From horror movies to religious rituals, UFO sightings, spicy foods, Davies will talk about the subconscious drives that lie in all of us. What is it that people find attractive? And why do many people believe in ghosts? And why do some people worship celebrities? Maybe the answers to these questions will help you begin to understand more about yourself and what you find fascinating. Jim, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. So one of the things that you mentioned in your book is that human beings are fond, addicted, or drawn to information.
Right.
Tell me what you mean by that, and what kind of information are they drawn to?
Well, we are really, really a curious species, and part of what the niche that we've filled over the course of history is that of being the smartest creatures around in terms of being able to figure things out. And a lot of the competition we face is not from other animals so much as each other. So it's always been to our advantage to be able to outsmart people around us. So we've evolved to get very sensitive to the certain kinds of information that will allow us to gain a competitive advantage over the environment, other creatures, and especially each other. And that leads to a lot of predictions about what kinds of things that we are interested in. For example, we're very interested in social information because we live in these very complex social hierarchies, and we have since at least the dawn of agriculture. And back during our evolutionary history as well as today, our success with reproduction, with gathering resources, with being able to find a roof over our head, we are really intimately tied with dealing with other people. And if we can't accurately perceive and understand what's going on socially, we're not going to be able to do that. And that translates into other aspects other than just who's around you. But that means we also like movies about people, and we like religions about people and things like that.
Jim, wouldn't you see? For me, I would divide it up into two different parts. Maslow's hierarchy. I think that people need information for survival, and I think they also need it for identity. Most people are really struggling to find that identity. For the most part, one is given to them, and later on, some who are lucky to break away from religious institutions or internalized institutions, they themselves find their own identity. But isn't some information just the sheer pleasure of being able to experience more pleasure? Kind of like morally?
Well, we experience it like that, but that doesn't mean that's where it's from. Like when you eat a cupcake, you're experiencing it as pure pleasure, but that doesn't mean that you're not, you evolved to experience fat and sugar and stuff as pleasurable because it used to be really rare.
But
they're not mutually exclusive. You know?
That is to me fascinating because I think that is true for the most people. I do not like sweets. I like food. I'm a real foodie. But look me at a cupcake and I have no interest. Now, why would that be?
Well, and people differ, what we call individual differences. They have their little tweaks and tastes and this kinds of things. And there are people who like sweets more than others, and there are people who like fatty stuff more than others. But basically, people's food preferences, although we focus on the differences, they are constrained greatly by our nutritional needs. So there are very few people who like rotting food, or people like to eat rocks, or things that aren't in some way nutritious, or used to be nutritious, or taste like something that was nutritious. So even you as a foodie, you probably appreciate foods with more fat in them.
I do, because fat tastes good. I think it's two things. I think number one, fat tastes good, and I think I'm also, as a human being, pre-programmed to like fat because it burns the hottest and the longest, and it's better for survival.
Yeah, and sugar is like that too. I mean, you might not You might not like sugar as much as the guy sitting next to you, but you like sugar more than, you know, a creature that doesn't need sugar to live. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kind of things I'm trying to get at in the book are that, although we tend to focus on the differences between us, the similarities are really kind of overpowering. And that, if you want an understanding of what drives people to be attracted to things, it's good to look at the commonalities we have across all of us.
So let me ask this question, something that I personally despise, but tell me, why do people love gossip? Because I have my own thoughts.
I want
to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, gossip seems to serve a very important societal function. So as I said, humans live in groups, right? You talk about Maslow's hierarchy, but every part of that hierarchy is involved with social groups. You can't even get food and shelter easily without dealing with other people and cooperating with other people. Gossip is interesting because it seems to play the role of keeping people in check. A lot of people will they will stop themselves from doing bad things because they're afraid of the gossip that will come back to haunt them. Because humans can speak language, the stuff that you do, if you're a jerk to somebody as a chimp, the only person who knows it and will ever know it are the people who see it directly, because chimps can't communicate that to each other. But in human beings, if you do something wrong in a community, it can haunt you for decades. People talking about it, not endlessly talking about it, ruining your reputation, hurting your chances for survival, for mating, and everything else. So gossip, it turns out that most gossip is actually true. And it seems to serve a role of keeping people in social check.
All right, so I'm going to take the opposite stance, and I want you to tell me what you think. I think that gossip is a function of that very few people have this idea that they have an obligation to find out what they're supposed to be doing in life, and they put all their energies into try to regulate or control, just the way parents do. Most parents don't have children to find out what their identity is. They have children in order to have bragging rights so they get fit into society. So I see this dynamic between society trying to kind of keep itself cohesive and those people who don't give a damn about gossip and in fact fight it end up being the real heroes. Those who broke away and first were talked about, later on were admired, just like in rock and roll and so many people who were mocked for having religious differences or scientific differences, later on they became heroes.
Yeah, I think that with gossip's got a bad reputation, and I think that it's easy to look at the bad parts of it. Thinking about gossip, I mean, there's always gossip that some people don't like. But basically, anytime you're talking about someone's reputation, that is considered a form of gossip. And you probably are interested in what I would call gossip when you are trying to choose somebody to hire to do a job.
I don't know. If I said Jim is a great writer, I love this book, and I think he has a lot of interesting things to say, I don't think that's gossip.
Oh, well, sociologists would consider that gossip. I mean, that's spreading reputational.
Well, that's why they're all fucked up.
to answer your question, that apparently is what the purpose that gossip serves. Now, what's kind of cool is that when religions get created, the kinds of things that gods are interested in, and I mean gods very broadly, these are gods that we normally think of, but also supernatural trees or whatever, ghosts, any kind of supernatural agent that a religion might have, the kind of stuff that they have access to tends to be what's called strategic information, which is the same information that people tend to gossip about. So, you know, when people say, oh, well, God can watch what's happening, God knows what's going on, you know, they're more likely to say, yes, well, God cares more about whether you cheated on your girlfriend than, the square root of how many kibbles your dog ate for breakfast added to the number of kibbles eaten in lunch. You might say, well, okay, an omniscient God might know that, but that's not what we really care about. That's not what we're interested in.
Right, but isn't it interesting in religion that gossip is one of the deadly sins? And yet, what you're saying is that we accept gossip as a part of society that keeps people in check. Meaning, does adultery keep people in check? Does stealing keep people in check? Why does gossip keep people in check?
Well, people don't want to be gossiped about, so that makes them behave a little better. That's the theory. I mean, you might disagree with it, but this is the theory that's out there about why gossip is there. I'll tell you another cool thing about gossip. They did a study to see which gossip would get spread, and it turns out that the gossip that's most juicy, the gossip that people most want to talk about, is stuff that is relevant to their social standing. So let's take I'm in a university environment, so I'll use that as an example. So let's say there's a student, just an undergraduate student here, and they hear that a professor was involved with a scandal, and they might lose their job. That's pretty interesting. They might gossip about that. They might hear about a professor who just won a giant award. They're less likely to gossip about that. And the theory is that students don't care so much about stuff that isn't relevant to their standing in the social hierarchy. Somebody who's above them in the social hierarchy, a professor, getting even better, isn't going to have a chance of changing their place on the ladder. But a professor coming down, that's more interesting. Well, likewise, they're interested in people way below them coming up, like, you know, a poor person getting rich or something like that. A poor person getting even more in trouble is not as gossip worthy. So it's interesting that people are most interested in the gossip that might affect their standing in the social ladder.
Which brings me to the point that, you know, when we think of the switch in human evolution from animals who were not using their frontal lobe or didn't have a frontal lobe even developed to Homo sapiens and the gradual development of the frontal lobe. But we're still in this evolutionary process to some extent, you know, and to some extent that people are like crabs in a bucket. And when one starts to climb up, there's this natural instinct to pull them down unless a person individualizes. Tell me what you think about that.
Okay, you're saying that if someone who's standing out in the crowd will tend to be punished by the group?
Who gets gossiped most about in a negative way are politicians, even though they deserve it.
That's because they're high up. There's tons of gossip about movie stars and anybody who's famous. Negative gossip is more interesting because we're more interested in the big people coming down than the big people going up. Like I said, because that's what's most relevant to our standing in the social hierarchy. Most of our brains don't realize that, you know, Kim Kardashian is in such a different stratosphere of social fame that, you know, no matter how far down she comes, you know, you're not going to be more famous than Kim Kardashian. But our old brains don't realize that.
Now, Jim,
they're treating everybody as though they're in our community.
You're a social scientist. Why is Kim Kardashian have any standard at all? What the hell did she ever do?
Well, she's quite attractive. that's one thing. And, you know, she got on TV. I don't really know a hell of a lot about the history of Kim Kardashian, so I don't really know why exactly she's so famous. But she does have...
I'll tell you why. You know, she's the best self-promoter that one has ever seen. But other than that, she's done nothing.
Okay. But if you're going to say that, then self-promotion actually is... that is something. You know, some people...
Oh,
just
yeah,
can't
absolutely.
You know?
100%. Yeah, I agree.
But now that she's got some sort of a critical mass, then, you know, people just tend to think that what's happening to her is important and interesting.
So why let's talk about the difference between having intelligence and yet at the same time being very superstitious. How do they go together? Why do they go together?
They go together because a mark of an intelligent mind is the ability to find patterns in the environment, right? An intelligent person figures things out, they understand how the world works, and that a lot of that is seeing patterns where other people can't see them. The problem is that when you're in a situation that is very difficult to understand, and you're searching for understanding, you desperately need to understand it, but you can't, your mind starts entertaining stranger and stranger ideas to try to make sense of it. And that's where superstition tends to arise. So if you'll notice in pitchers in baseball, pitchers have a lot of rituals. Batters have a lot of rituals which are superstitious. They like touch their hat and, you know, they spit or whatever they do. And you notice that outfielders don't do that. And the reason is because fielding is much more predictable and less chaotic than batting and pitching is. You can pitch a great pitch and it can go either way and it's really hard to predict. And that uncertainty is really, really tough on the human mind, and people struggle for ways to understand it, and they end up making rituals because they think that maybe something that they did affected it. where fielders never have that. So in one sport,
I think that's really good insight, Jim. I have another thought. You know, it's based on neuroplasticity, which is what I've been doing for 37 years, and that is that the mammal brain, the brain that we use literally from birth is intensely superstitious and gets all its facts. All the facts that it gets is from the environment around them, and it's never really discerned or tested or set to any type of standard. So superstition comes in for lack of using the rational cognitive brain that basically looks at things in a more factual way.
Yeah, but you can't use your rational brain to come up with pattern detection. Like, there's no way to use your rational brain. Well, there's just no, it's not a logical process. Like, when you notice that every Macintosh computer looks like one thing and PCs tend to look like another thing, that's not your rational brain coming up with some rule. You can't even articulate necessarily how you're able to perceive that difference, right? Or if you notice, you know, that every time this happens, something else happens, that's all subconscious.
I think that's an integration between the cognition of the mammal brain and the rational brain being able to put it together. Otherwise, it would just come up as an emotion.
No, the actual associative power of detecting patterns in the environment, I don't believe is something that is a deliberative process. I mean, you can disagree with me on that, but I mean, to me,
that's okay. It's not like that's the problem.
I don't see how you can logically deduce causal structure. To me, like every time, or any kind of pattern, like every time patterns seem to arise, I just am aware of it, and then I can make a rational judgment over whether I'm going to believe it or not.
Okay, I go with that. So let me ask you a question. In Western culture, yeah. You know, there. Let's talk about religion and ghosts. Okay,
yeah.
And tell me why, outside of the obvious that you know we're tribal people that every tribe, every cave, they had their superstitions in order to control the movement, the momentum, the structure of the cave. So what's the function of religion, and do people who head these religions, do they really believe in it, or is it more about keeping people in line than it is anything else?
I think it's both, and the reasons that we have religion are manyfold, and that's part of the reason it's a book-length argument, but I'll say a couple things about it. And one is that for ghosts, for example, we seem to believe in ghosts because of something called person permanence, which is this what allows us to know that somebody still exists even when they walk out of the room, right? So if somebody leaves the room or you stop hearing them or whatever, you don't assume that they vanished from the earth. You still think they're hanging around. The idea is that this feeling is still there for a few months after someone dies. So you get this very weird feeling like you know that they're dead, but at the same time you feel like they could call or show up and just walk into the room at any time. And that weird feeling leads to, religion steps in to provide an explanation for this incongruity that you're sensing. And ghosts seems to be, in any kind of afterlife actually, is one kind of way to try to answer that, right? Interestingly, the ghost mythology that we tend to have about being invisible, being in houses, having, you know, being associated with auditory, you know, hallucinations and that kind of thing seems to come from carbon monoxide poisoning in the Victorian age. When people had carbon monoxide, sometimes there would be leaks in their house and plants would die and they would hear hallucinations and they wouldn't be able to sleep and people would get depressed. And suddenly we have this huge mythology of houses being haunted, and it turns out you fix the problem and all that stuff goes away.
And today it's mushrooms and acid. What's the difference?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's right. So that's the attribution theory of religion, is that people attribute religious significance to things that are, you know, natural things in the world. Do you want me to go on to the reason why we have religion and its social role?
Yeah, I'm curious of what you think. I think for myself, yeah. Let me throw out what I think. I do believe that religion is the need to understand more than what we do. And in fact, I think we are in our infancy, you know, in terms of our own human evolution, and there's so much more to understand. And I am personally a theist. I'm a believer that there is something greater than ourselves. I'm Jewish by background. not orthodox in nature, but I do believe that there is something. I also strongly believe that everyone should keep their religion to themselves, and no one should tell anyone else what to believe. But I'm curious as to why.
Very Jewish of you.
Exactly. So tell me what, you know, what your thoughts on it.
Well, the best theory I've seen, and it's not ironclad, you know, scientific truth or anything. It's just it's a theory. It's got some evidence for it. Is that we have evolved to have religions in general, and please, you know, I want the listeners not to just think about the big five, the, you know, Christianity and Islam and Hinduism and stuff, but, you know, there are probably 4,000 or so religions in the world today, and there probably have been many, many, many thousands over the course of history. We're talking about all religions here. And the idea, and religions are always popping up and vanishing, and some catch on and some don't. So anyway, the idea is, why is there religion in every culture that's ever been studied? And why does it seem to be this thing that is always popping up? And the best theory I've seen is that it encourages pro-social behavior. So just as gossip is the front line for keeping people in check, when maybe only one person is watching, okay, you do something bad, I gossip about you, your reputation is ruined, okay, what if nobody's watching? What's going to keep you from stealing everybody's water or taking someone when nobody's watching? So the idea is that the groups of people that had religion and gods that cared about this strategic knowledge, those are the groups that had better social coherence. And it turns out that making people think about religious topics makes them more favorable toward being good to their in-group. Okay, so it's not that religion makes people better people in general. This is a study show. Okay?
No, I don't believe
religion. Not that they make them more charitable in general.
I don't believe that religion
makes people.
But it makes
them more charitable to their in-group.
Well,
so the idea is that religion evolved to help people, to help groups outcompete other groups.
Jim, I don't believe that religion makes people, in fact, more better citizens or better people. I think that morals do. I think that, you know, a sense of personal identity does. I think a sense of getting pleasure, I call it moral hedonism, getting pleasure out of helping someone does. But I need you to explain to me, you know, from a social scientist point of view, an academic point of view, how do we get to a murderous, sadistic group like ISIS? Where do they arise from?
Well, you got to understand that religion is, if the theory is right, religion is about being better to your in-group. So, you know, a group that, religious people...
They blow up their own. They blow up other Muslims. How is that better to your in-group?
No, okay, but you got to... People have varying ideas of who their in-group is, and you know, I mean, you probably have seen this in the Jewish religion, but in any human groups, it's you know... sometimes you're your own group, sometimes you and your brother, sometimes you and your brother against the world, sometimes, you know, people have different ideas. So, of course, they might feel some solidarity with Islam in general, but most people identify very closely with the very small in-group that they have, right?
Okay, what you're saying is that they exist because they identify within their own in-group. And the identification within their in-group allows them to eliminate, slaughter, and massacre anyone that's not in their in-group.
That's part of it. But the other part of it is that part of the way it works is that societies that punish bad behavior are more likely to thrive as well. So what happens is, I mean, you know what it's like. People like... You know, Jews pick on other Jews and their behavior. They don't like go and talk about like what other people are doing. In-groups will like try to keep their own house in check, and they will punish people in their own in-group to try to make them behave well.
That's absolutely true, but it is the degree of the punishment. Meaning, everyone, you know, parents punish their children to make them believe, you know, to behave well. You know,
right.
Within, you know, Judaism, you have many branches of Judaism, you know, from Hasidic to Lubavitcher to Orthodox to Conservadox and so on and so forth. But there is an essence, even among Judaism, that to some extent there's an identification that you don't go out of your way to hurt or harm another person. You go out of your way to teach and instruct.
Well, I think that's admirable, but you know, it's not, you know, different religions are going to manifest their what they do in different ways, and it's not that that's a universally, even within, you know, the broad range of Judaism, that's not universally thought of either. There are violent Jews, and there's violent everything. You know, we've even got violent Buddhists. I never thought I'd see today, but you know, we've got people will, you know, branch off into their own.
Well, Buddhism isn't a religion per se; it's a philosophy, and you know, therefore you could embrace any philosophy. Let's switch over to conspiracy theories. Do you like them?
Sure. Do I like them?
Yeah.
I can't.
Okay, so why do people love them?
Okay, well, so conspiracy theories, of all the things I talk about in the book about what, you know, what's compelling, conspiracy theories probably are the most compelling kinds of things for in the way that they have so much of what we find interesting about the world. So a conspiracy theory involves social interaction, right? So it's about conspiracy theories. They're always about people in high places doing secret stuff. So we have secret knowledge, which is strategic knowledge, and then the conspiracy theorist thinks that they have knowledge that nobody else does. So that makes them feel like they're in a position of power. And indeed, people who feel disenfranchised and alienated are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. Further, the conspiracy theory usually involves some sort of a cover-up. And what's interesting about it is that cover-ups make it very hard to disprove a theory. So, you know, you'll say, listen, you got a conspiracy theory about aliens or something. Listen, the government said that was actually an aircraft that they were testing that was secret. And then that doesn't count as disconfirming evidence to the conspiracy theorist. They'll say, oh, that's what they want you to think. And then what happens is that in the mind of the conspiracy theorist, they think that you've just given them more supporting evidence for their conspiracy theory.
But Jim,
and if I said, "Oh, they actually found a spaceship," that would also be confirming evidence. So
Jim,
they get into this mental trap.
You said before that if you believe that 65% of gossip is true, isn't it true that people who are in power hide knowledge in order to keep control of that power? Why wouldn't we make the same, pick a number out of the air and say 65% of the conspiracy theories are true?
Well, conspiracy theories are, they turn out, I think factually, if you looked at it, although I haven't seen the study of it, if you were to look at them historically, you'd find that far fewer than 65% of them are true. That's just an empirical observation. I think that the biggest mistake conspiracy theorists
make is threw out the 65% because you threw it out on the gossip. Gossip empirically, I don't think we'd find 65% of gossip is true.
No, we do. We do. There are studies of that. There are studies of that, and it is cited in the book. I don't remember if it's exactly 65%, but it's definitely over 50%. But most gossip is true. We just tend to focus on the stuff that pernicious lies and stuff. But a conspiracy theory itself is extraordinarily complex, and it might even be that many of the things in the conspiracy theory are true, but the entire narrative doesn't make any sense at all.
Do you think that sometimes that you could suffer and others of academicitis, which is that someone does a study based upon, you know, a fairly limited number of people, and all of a sudden that study becomes a truth? Why isn't that study simply a study?
Well, because that science should replicate stuff, and yeah, you're right. It could be wrong. But the other thing is that if you are going to disagree with it, you need to look and say, what do you think went wrong with the study?
Oh, absolutely. You have to make your own study.
Or make your own study and try to disprove it. And that's the wonderful thing about science. But I will say this, is that our intuitions about what the nature of the world is like is no match for science, even a single study. So most people think dreams are bizarre. Okay? Careful studies show that if you wake people up at several times during the night, most dreams are not bizarre at all. Most dreams are pretty boring. But we don't remember the dreams that are boring very well, so we get this skewed bias. But if I tell somebody, oh, most dreams aren't bizarre, and they just want to trust their own intuitions, they're like, oh, screw your study. It's just one study or something like that. I'm going to believe what I want to believe. That's the road to getting the facts wrong.
Well, meaning they're different cycles of REM sleep, and in each cycle of REM sleep, there are different dreams that manifest. And some are very boring, and some are very violent, and some are very sexual. So it all depends on which REM sleep study that we're looking at. But I want to jump into something else. I want to jump into the idea, what's the similarities between OCD and religiosity? So let's go a little bit more into religion. Do you feel that religion itself, at one point, it was necessary in order for people to thrive? And do you think that religions inherently can get along, accept one another, allow each other to grow, and at the same time, there could be a shared intellectual and scientific interweaving so that religion and science don't necessarily conflict?
I think that religion and science are probably going to have a lot of conflict for a long time. And I'm not particularly hopeful about them getting along very well. I think that some of the strides the secular world has made in finding a lingua franca of ethics and law and this kind of thing has gone a long way. The separation of church and state, I think, is a wonderful innovation.
I agree.
That has allowed us to have people practice their religions within certain bounds of ethics that we as a society agree upon. And once in a while, you'll get a religion saying, look, we don't accept those standards. And then you get conflict, right? So you want people being able to marry more than one person, or you want ritual sacrifice, or who knows what. And those are where conflicts are going to come up. But I have hope that over time, the religions will adjust to sort of the rule of law and secular society's ideas of tolerance of each other and that kind of thing.
And moving right along, why are there so many songs about sex and love?
Why are there so many songs about sex and love? Good question. So the historical studies of popular songs show that indeed there is a huge amount of it is about sex and love. Finding a partner is a major life goal of most people. It's easy to look at evolution and figure out why, because every one of our ancestors managed to hook up, right, and have a kid. So the drive to do that is very, very strong. And also it's a very emotional thing and a very complicated psychological thing, in a way that finding food is not. So you also it's very important to have food. It's very important to have a house over your head. But you don't get as many songs about tracking down a hamburger, presumably because it's not as psychologically deep. But this is rather speculative. But certainly the importance of finding a mate in this life is a major preoccupation of many people for a lot of their lives, at least until they've settled down and they can.
Right, but you're actually putting two things together. Sex and love are not really complicated. Sex is one of the most base things that every animal does and every Homo sapien does, and love is simply an emotional attachment. Having sustainable sex and sustainable love and a healthy relationship, that's the difficult part. So I would say that the songs about sex and love are because we gravitate towards pleasure and away from pain, so we tend to sing about things that create pleasure.
I think that's also true, and I think that songs tend to be happy, although sad songs do strike a chord with us as well. And some of those happy songs are about love, and then you've got a whole lot of sad songs about love. But people are definitely interested. That's the point: is that they're always interested in stories about love and love lost and that kind of thing.
Well, the reason that people are really into sad songs is because most people have failed in love, or lots of them, and people like to identify that they're not the only freak on the planet that's not in love. So sad songs make them feel better.
That's very possibly true. I'm sure that's part of it. The kind of catharsis we feel when we watch a sad movie, or we watch a movie knowing that we're going to cry at it, that's an interesting phenomenon. I haven't delved very deeply into that literature, but I know that there are people working on why we deliberately go out of our way to make ourselves feel sad about that kind of stuff.
Talk to me about scary movies. Why do people want to be scared? Why do they go on roller coasters? Why do they watch scary movies? Why do they have fixations on, turning on things about Ebola? Tell me why.
All right. Well, part of our ability to survive in this world is that we have evolved to be very sensitive to dangers. So when we hear about a danger, our first response is to believe it and to pay attention to it, and, you know, believe that it's relevant to our lives. Now, we evolved for the vast majority of our evolutionary history in a world that had no representations at all. And when I say, now, there were linguistic representations, but what I mean by that is there weren't a lot of pictures, there weren't a lot of, you know, if you saw a face, it was probably a person. It was probably a person right in front of you. And only very recently do we have this huge bombardment of imagery and sound that is not actually of a real person. It is actually just a picture on a wall or on a screen or something like that. As a result, most of our minds are not very well suited for distinguishing the difference between people and images, for example. Now, when you put those kind of things together, we get this idea that danger, when we see it in any kind of medium, we assume is important and relevant to our lives. So when you're driving down the road and you see an accident, what do? You look. You look at the accident because some part of your mind thinks there's danger. That's something that I need to worry about. I need to pay attention to it. Maybe I can learn something from it that will help me avoid that danger in the future. And when you watch a movie about vampires or something, you might be riveted to it and you might think it's really important at some level because
you might run into a vampire one day.
Part of your brain thinks it's really happening. Yeah, part of you thinks it's really happening, then you might have nightmares about it, which is further evidence that your mind is rehearsing, trying to figure out what to do when this happens to me.
I think that would be true of kids, because at the end of the day, they don't really have the ability to fully separate fact from fiction.
Oh, okay? But people, no. Adults can't do it either, because what happens is when you look at a screen and you see a person up there, you cannot see it as a bunch of dots of light on a screen. When they say something, you cannot interpret that as just a bunch of sounds generated by a speaker. You hear words and you see people. And although you can tell yourself, and the frontal parts of your brains, your deliberative areas, can know in some sense that it's just a movie, you cannot help but feel the emotions, see the people. You can ameliorate it a little bit, but you can't shut it off because the parts of your brain in the back that are detecting phases, detecting goals, detecting emotions, and simulating what's going on socially, you cannot shut that down with the front part of your brain.
Jim, I've never been scared of a scary movie in my life, and I wouldn't
watch. Have you ever been moved by a movie? Have you ever been moved in any way by a movie?
Absolutely. Meryl Streep does it
okay.
for me.
How is that possible if you know that it's just a movie?
It's not the movie that I'm moved by. I'm moved by the topic because I know that that topic is relevant. The topic is relevant to something that I could relate to, something that I could actually experience emotionally if I so choose to do it.
Yeah, I think that your interpretation is giving your frontal areas a little too much credit.
I think we are giving your mammal brain, your emotional brain much too credit, because that is the brain that actually allows people, you know, to do things that are, you know, is very often so contrary. You know, why do people drink? Because it feels good. They don't process it, you know, they don't process through their rational brain. It's going to, if I overdrink, I'm going to get psoriasis. My health is going to be problematic. My judgment won't be good. I can take my license away. So why not give the frontal lobe more of the spotlight, since it makes the better decisions?
Well, it sometimes does and sometimes doesn't, right? But no. I mean, we're talking about what?
No, it makes the right decisions. Tell me where the frontal lobe doesn't make the right decisions.
Okay, well, sometimes the more associative parts of your mind can detect patterns that your frontal lobes can't make any sense of. So if you're ever in a situation, you're like, this seems dangerous or something, it might be a good idea for you to get out of that situation, even if you can't put your finger on rationally any facts that would lead you to conclude that it is dangerous. Okay, you rely on your instincts all the time when you're driving a car. You don't have time for your rational brain to actually figure it all out.
In that case, I completely agree with you. You're relying on your instincts. I don't know if that is in fact going on your emotions. I think that is instinctual,
And there's a lot more to your back. There's a lot more of your frontal lobes are a lot more than just the back part of your brain is a lot more than emotions.
But you take somebody being mugged, and the reason that those who are mugged, especially those who have weapons, the reason they don't use their weapons is because they emotionalize it and they freeze up. Where the frontal lobe would simply say, "I have a weapon. What's the best time? What's the best place in to use it?" And kind of figure it out and do it.
I'm just. I think it's a challenge to everybody to know when to trust your deliberative processing and when to trust your guts. But I mean, I tell you, like with a lot of moral judgments too, you're relying on principles is often good and it's not always good. Sometimes your gut is telling you the right thing and sometimes it's not. There's an interesting story from Huckleberry Finn. The story, and it's fiction, of course, but I think we can all relate to it in that Huckleberry Finn feels that Jim is should be treated with respect, but his deliberative process, what he's been taught and everything, that a person, that he's a slave and he doesn't believe that he should be subjugated, in that case, it's his rational brain that's wrong. You know, we want him to go with his gut to say that he's actually a person, this kind of thing.
Okay.
It's a challenge, I think, that people have to face every day about whether, to trust their gut or to trust their principles, because their principles might be off.
I mean, the principles might be off, but that's not their frontal lobe. Very often their principles...
Oh, it absolutely is.
Well, very often their principles are that which was passed on to them by their parents, and they emotionalize it. They do not intellectualize it, so I would not agree. But let me jump into something that's so important. Is beauty... Is it really in the eye of the beholder, or is there truly beauty and truly not beauty?
I think that there are human constants to beauty that can be that culture can override, and individual differences can override. So I think if you look at the span of human existence and what people find beautiful, most of it looks the same. But that is not to say that you can't find an individual who disagrees, or a movement, an art movement that disagrees, or a culture that disagrees with a particular thing. But in general, when you look at the broad strokes, I think an alien coming here and looking at all the stuff that we find beautiful would say, yeah, that's all about the same.
Interesting. So what you would say is that from a scientific basis or an anthropological basis, that there is such a thing as a beautiful woman that most people in the cave would agree that she's beautiful?
Well, they've done cross-cultural studies of beauty, and although people differ on things like hair color or whatever, most the cross-cultural studies do tend to agree on the beauty of a particular face, for example.
Okay, it's funny because what happens is that when they did a study, when the pageantry, I think, I don't remember which pageantry it was in the 70s, when it was compromised, and they wanted the computers of the day to actually pick the winner of these beauty pageants, what they found out is what the computers picked is beauty is symmetry, and that we are prone to look at beauty as that which is symmetrical. And for that which is not symmetrical or out of the box, that became less beautiful.
Right. So that there were some very influential studies that found that facial symmetry was a big part of beauty. Also that average faces were a big part of beauty. One of the problems is that people are pretty good at detecting the beauty of only half a face. So I can show you half of a face, and you can tell whether it's an attractive person or not, and that has nothing to do with symmetry. So it's only, these things are only part of the issue. So it's actually really complicated. I think it's a fascinating topic, but certainly averageness has something to do with it. Symmetry has something to do with it. Health has something to do with it, and et cetera.
Well, if you had one closing thought to leave our audience, because you were wonderful and I wish I had more time with you, what would be your pearl of wisdom, Jim?
Pearl of wisdom is that, the reason to read the book at all is that that the reasons that you find things compelling, the reason you find them beautiful or scary or believable, has a lot to do with understandable parts of your psychology. And if you understand those things, then you can have a richer appreciation of your world, and you can be a little bit more skeptical of people trying to take advantage of you by making things sound compelling when they're just maybe not good for you.
Jim, thanks for the book. Thanks for the time. And you and I shall talk later.
That sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to once again thank Jim Davies for coming onto our show. Pick up a copy of his book, Riveted, on Amazon.com. And while you're there, visit his website at jimdavies.org. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. I'm your problem solver. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com. Go to glucksolutions.org. Keep listening. Till next time.